is the greatest boxer of all time, one of our most beloved athletes. But there was a time when he was absolutely hated in this country. Malcolm X, there was a time when very few people knew who he was. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Spike Lee made his movie. So as you said, you know, history in and of itself is such an odd thing. There's a movie coming out in about a month or so about the killing of Fred Hampton called Judas and the Black Messiah. And 3-4 months from now, a lot of people in this country are going to know who Fred Hampton was. But today, there's a lot of people who don't know. And so it's interesting to watch how people become informed. And, you know, history in and of itself is a myth, right? Especially the history that we're taught in school. And the country that we live in right now is a byproduct of the myths of history that have been peddled and the bill of goods that was sold to so many of us and some people who actually believed it. You know, one of the biggest myths in this country is that history is written by the winners. And that's the biggest lie you're ever going to hear, because the history of the Civil War was literally written by the Confederacy. And as a direct result of that, the vast majority of people, especially in the states that formerly been in the Confederacy, is this actual belief that the Civil War was over states' rights. Because every textbook that said the Civil War is fought over the rights of states to own slaves was edited to get the own slaves part out. And I can tell you, as someone who has read the Articles of Secession for every state that was in the Confederacy, every single one lists they were fighting to keep their slaves. So when I hear people quote me about history or try to correct me, before I correct them, I usually will go do some research, but it's like, I'm the last person you want to come out with, you know, with your idea of historical facts, because most people just don't get it. It's interesting because the moment you start to dig beneath the surface of what I call the historical myths, you find these things that are shocking, and most people don't like to be shocked. Most people don't like to be told they were wrong. Most people don't like to be told, hey, the Star Wars prequels were terrible, because they have invested so much of their self-worth in both the history that they think they know and the things that they love, the things that their identity is built around. And we're seeing a cross-section of this country right now fighting to hold on to those myths. And this is what America is going to have to deal with. Not to get all political, because we are talking about a graphic novel, right? So,
yeah, I remember.
So I've never been political. So.
Yeah, I remember hating history class in high school because the textbooks were always like, well, this happened because it was inevitable. And then after high school, I checked out the series on PBS, Eyes on the Prize. Mm-hmm. And I was like, damn, you know, things could have gone either way, like the Mississippi Freedom Caucus, you know, they crashed the convention. And it was like, you know, all these long shots, like some of them failed, some of them succeeded. And it was like, history is really dynamic and interesting.
It is. It's so, and it's funny that you mentioned Eyes on the Prize, because in my memory that is not the best at this age, that might have been one of the first places I really truly learned about the Panthers. It may have been before that, but I know that there was 2 seasons of Eyes on the Prize, and at least one of those seasons had several episodes, because one of them was specifically about Fred Hampton. And I love that series, even though it's pushing up on 40 years old. I think it's still relevant, and I'm always telling people to watch it.
Yeah, there's a quote in there that to this day I refer to. They're interviewing a guy, I believe he's from New York City, and you know, he's a white man, and he's speaking about his suspicions about Black people and Black men in particular. And I always cite it to people because it's strangely honest. It's messed up what he says, but it's strangely honest. And I'm paraphrasing, but he says something like, you know, the reason why, you know, when I see a Black man, I tense up and whatever, is because I'm afraid that at some point he's going to think about all the terrible things that my people have done to his people, and he's going to want to take it out on me. And I cite that because I think a lot of people aren't as disgustingly honest, insightful and honest as this guy, you know what I mean? But I think they are playing out that same dynamic in their fears, you know, of Black people in particular, without even having the conscious, like, honesty to know that that's what they're acting out. So, but yeah, no, that series was incredible. And you're right. I mean, if we had that in the classroom, I think history would have been a lot more engaging for a lot of us. I remember my teacher talking about Manifest Destiny without any type of critical analysis. And I just was like, this sounds like nonsense. You know what I mean? But like, it was delivered with a straight face as like, well, yeah, you got to manifest your destiny, blah, blah, blah. Like, so.
One not insignificant difference between the era of the Panthers and nowadays is back in 1970s, no one had a phone camera.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, for some descendants of the white guys with fire hoses, that hasn't seemed to catch up with them. They're still doing crazy stuff for the camera.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's because there's been no accountability, you know? And I think, and this isn't to defend anybody, but I know that, like, while we were working on this book, while I was doing the writing and the research, there was a lot of the Me Too stuff was going on. And last summer there was some more Me Too stuff that happened within the comics industry. And in this situation, it was almost everybody involved was people that I knew. And it was like, you know, as a man, it really took women who were really good friends of mine to come out with their stories in ways that they never should have had to come out with, for me to really finally go, oh, I get what this is all about now, you know? And it's not to say that I was dismissive of Me Too before any of this, but it was, I think that there's, for a lot of people, there's a moment of awakening, for lack of a better term, where you just go, oh, and you can't go back. You can't go back to how you saw things before. And as to me, as painful as that moment of awakening is, like, we should all have it. What I do try to tell people is that we never want to erase anything, truly erase anything, because then we forget that it happened, you know, and we need to remember these things. I think I always say, you know, going back to what I was saying about the rewriting of the Civil War history and the history of the Confederacy, yeah, that's essentially the same thing as cancel culture. It's like you erase something from history and it just doesn't go away. So it's fine to get rid of something and to change something, but we need to keep the artifacts and the memories and the lessons. Otherwise, this is how it keeps happening over and over and over again.
Well, one of the things that is obviously important for both of you in putting together the Black Panther Party Illustrated History here is complexity. And you you show that the main players in the Black Panthers, they were not above a hustle. And let's see, was it, it was Huey Newton's idea to start selling copies of Mao's Little Red Book to Berkeley students, right?
Yep. Well, at least that's what everybody says. So we'll go with that as being the gospel truth. Everybody says that story. There's a part of me suspects that it might have been somebody else's idea. But yeah, that was how they raised money to buy guns, actually, was selling copies of the Red Book.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we're talking about the illustrated history of the Black Panther Party. We're joined today by writer David F. Walker and artist Marcus Kwame Anderson. I want to ask Marcus, you were born in Jamaica, right? Kingston, Jamaica?
Yeah, I was born in Kingston. We moved here when I was about, well, just under 2 years old. So, you know, but definitely, you know, I mean, Jamaica was all around me in my family and, you know, people that we were around.
How has that influenced your work? You said that you really appreciate the opportunity to represent the diversity of the African diaspora. So you take kind of an international stand on artistic influence. And when I say artistic influence, it doesn't have to be just the visual arts.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, that's a very good question. So, obviously, I've lived the majority of my life in the United States, and I've experienced being a Black man in the United States. It's not like, you know, police are going to be like, oh, wait, he's Jamaican, you know, and treat you better. So it's kind of like I've had the Black American experience. So a lot of the creative people I've been influenced by, like specifically growing up, like there was very much a line between, like, you know, the musicians that I love, like, you know, the Bob Marleys, the Nina Simones. And these were people who musically created something that I really dug, but they were also communicating just Black experience, Black struggle, you know, Black hope, all of it, like, you know what I mean? And making like activist music. And I've referenced Public Enemy quite a bit in talking about this book, because hearing Chuck D speak about several Panthers on Takes a Nation and Millions to Hold Us Back, like, was really the first thing that made me be like, hey, I need to learn more about these people that he's speaking about. So I say all that to say that, like, Black American art, that whole, you know, blues culture, blues people, it really moved me and is a part of me and informed my creativity. But yeah, like, I definitely do not separate that from, you know, my heritage. And if you look at it, like, Stokely Carmichael became, you know, Kwame Ture, and, you know, moved to Africa, and some of my other heroes like Nina Simone and James Baldwin, you know, they lived abroad. So I like the idea of Blackness, because it's universal, is worldwide, you know what I mean? It includes all of us. So yeah, like, you know, my when I speak about diaspora, there is a reason why I specifically refer to that in my artist statements and biographies, because the struggle of Black people here, I'm a part of it. I'm not apart from it, you know, but I also, you know, that's informed by so many other people, you know, and the people we wrote about in this book, many of them studied people from around the world. So I have a wide array of influences, and my concept of Blackness is both here, but also just worldwide.
Yeah, I do want to ask about, you said you had already been enjoying a lot of David's work when you were tapped to do the artwork for the Black Panther Party graphic novel.
Yeah, I was, my best friend Leo, way back, we're talking like early 2000s, had a bunch of David's old magazine, Badass Mofo. So that was like the first time I came across anything David had done. And like, we geeked out over that. And then, yeah, like when I started seeing David's name pop up in comics, I just was right on it. And his Shaft graphic novel run was just amazing to me. And like my dad had, I would just raid my dad's old books, you know, when I was a kid, and he had like a couple of Shaft novels. And of course, you know, I liked the Richard Roundtree film, which I know David isn't as crazy about, but and I learned, you know, from David's retelling, because his version of John Shaft was the one from the novel, and it was just really, really cool to me. But like, I tell people that all the time when I talk about this book, I really feel fortunate. So the fact that David looked at my work and was like, I can see something in this work, you know what I mean, that would fit with this project, I'm just profoundly grateful for. You
know. Well, David, Marcus just mentioned your popular 1990s self-published zine series, Badass Mofo. And I may still have some copies myself. I know I donated a few issues to the local zine library. But yeah, that zine led to a series of books about blaxploitation films and spaghetti westerns and other cinema that you love, or maybe have a love-hate relationship with.
Yeah, led to all kinds of stuff. And sometimes it's interesting because this year is actually the 25th anniversary of Badass Mofo, which kind of blows my mind when I think about it. And it also blows my mind when I realize, you know, when I stop and think about how many people that I know now who knew me through that work long before we ever met personally. And I'm definitely planning something for the 25th anniversary, simply because I teach part-time now. I teach a writing course at Portland State University. And one of the things I try to express to my students is that you shouldn't run and hide and try to get rid of your old work. Even if you don't like your old work is what led you to who you are today. And so I think about that all the time with Badass Mofo. And so I've been going through some of the old writing, and it's interesting. When I first proposed this book to 10 Speed Press, I knew that they were going to ask for artists. And I knew Marcus's work through Snow Days, which was a webcomic that he was doing. And Marcus also does these portraits that are a little bit closer to what I would define as fine art. I think some people, you know, might still consider it a little bit commercial art, but there was a distinct style difference between some of this other work that he was doing and then the stuff in Snow Days. And so what I was seeing, though, was a very eclectic style that varied. And then I knew what he could do as a more traditional cartoonist, comic book artist. And so even before I had submitted his work, I had sort of buttered everybody up and explained why I wanted a specific style that people might look at and go, oh, this is kind of cartoony. And I said, yeah, you know, the reason I want that is because this is a pretty heavy subject. And, you know, if we have art that's too photorealistic or too, I guess, has too much of a hard edge, and this isn't to say that Marcus's art is soft in any capacity, but I want a style that would contrast the violence, some of the serious nature. I wanted it to be something that, like, if some seventh grade kid brought this book home from the library and their parents were like, what are you doing? Look at this Black Panther party book. And then they open it up and they go, wow, these pictures are really cool. Oh, this is kind of, you know, that's what I wanted. And I knew it. I knew that this guy could deliver it. So a lot of it was just like buttering up the editorial team and really keeping my fingers crossed that he would be interested in doing it and be available, because it was a lot of hard work. There's a lot to be said when you're doing a project like this of having somebody not only who you like their work and you trust their artistic ability, but you also know, and this was crucial too, I knew from the subject matter of art that Marcus was posting that he had some semblance of interest and understanding of what we were doing and what I wanted to go for. And that meant everything to me. And it still does. It still means everything to me.
Well, that's high praise. I mean, especially considering the range of artists that you've worked for. Marcus mentioned Shaft, the comic book Shaft. Bilkis Evely was an artist on that. And Bill Sienkiewicz, the legendary Bill Sienkiewicz, did the covers.
Him and Dennis Cowan, yeah.
Luke Cage for Marvel. You had Guillermo Sana and you had Sanford Green for Power Man and Iron Fist. So, you are valued as a writer.
Well,
your technique,
you know,
is valued.
And I appreciate that. With this project in particular, I felt like, you know, I've been moving more towards nonfiction, and, you know, at the risk of sounding like an egomaniac or something, I wanted to create a book about the Black Panther Party that would be remembered even after I'm gone, right? I really did. I wanted to create an indispensable text that could be the springboard for studying more about the Panthers or about the 60s. And I knew the only way that was going to happen was it had to look, and I don't say this lightly, it had to look better than it reads. There's a sequence in our book when the Panthers go to Sacramento to protest at the Capitol, and that entire sequence is one of my favorite sequences in the book. It's one of the most cinematic sequences. But there's one page in particular where you're on the steps of the Capitol, and with each panel, the Panthers are getting closer and closer. Like, I just love that page, and I know what I wrote. And I know that page exists because I wrote it, but what I wrote will never look as good as what Marcus put on that page. That's what comics are, right? I tell this to my students because, you know, the writing course I teach is writing for comics. It's like, if you're not trying to hook up with an artist who is better at telling a story with pictures than you are with words, forget about it. Just go home, you know, and that's it. People don't understand my commitment to this medium in that regard. When it comes to comics and graphic novels, you, as a writer, you're only going to be as good as the art that is in your book. So like I said, I've been lucky. I've never worked on a comic in my professional career that I'm embarrassed for people to look at. I have some stuff that I'm embarrassed for people to read the words on the page, but in terms of the images, they all look great.
David, I know that one of the fights that you've been battling is the stigma in our society against discussing depression and anxiety and mental health in general, mm-hmm. particularly among Black men. One of your quotes that I saw is, no one ever asks, hey man, how's your mentals?
No one, very few people ask that. No, I think that, you know, look, as a nation, not just as Black folks specifically, Black men specifically, but as a nation, we don't talk about mental health nearly enough. And there's a reason why so many people over just the last week have been walking around with a, you know, feeling like a little bit less weight on their shoulders, a little bit, you know, more relieved. And it's like, we're a nation that has been traumatized for 4 years straight. Now, the fact of the matter is that some of the people who've been traumatized don't realize they've been traumatized. But yeah, for me, it's, you know, the key thing is you're going to have enough trouble getting help if you have any sort of mental health issues as it is in this country, right? Because it's not necessarily taken that seriously. But if you're a Black person, you know, you're never taken seriously. And a lot of, there's a lot of people within the Black community that see these things as a sign of weakness. And I'm not gonna lie, I was definitely one of those people. When I was younger, I had no concept of what depression was really all about, what anxiety was really all about. Although in some cases, for quite some time, I was suffering from both and I just didn't know it, you know? I look back on my grandfather, he's been gone for many, many years, but like I'm more than 99% sure that my grandfather suffered from depression, but he was from a generation and era that never called it that. So, you know, my grandfather would just, he would say, oh, you know, I'm feeling blue today, or I'm feeling funky today. And that's how he talked about it. But when I look at, especially later in his life, some of the traits that he exhibited and some of the way he responded to things, it's like, oh yeah, no, he was depressed, you know, and it's interesting because as my depression has gotten worse over the years, it never occurred to me that, you know, my dad died really young, as did all of his brothers. It never occurred to me that maybe depression ran amongst men in my family, you know. But then when I also look back at the history of substance abuse in my family, it's like, oh yeah, maybe part of that was in response to the depression that they may have been dealing with. So to me, it's like, if we're gonna get up and talk about money, cash, hoes, things like that, all those other things that we've done, and like, we should also talk about anxiety, depression, and neuroses, you know? Maybe that'll be the title of my hip hop album.
You're gonna drop some rhymes, huh?
Yeah, right.
I mean, I have dabbled, so if you need somebody for bars, you know, I mean, it's like, no. But no, if I could add, I definitely want to cut you off, but like what you said right there, you literally took the words out of my mouth, because as I've done a lot of work in my own life, you know, with dealing with depression, and specifically between my late 20s and early 30s, you know, I went through a rough time, and I realized that, like, you know, I had what David just described. I had experienced that, having experienced depression before I even had a word for it, you know. And also, like, the more I learned about it, as I worked on it, I realized that pretty much, like, my entire nuclear family unit, I feel like we all suffered it, you know what I mean? I feel like it manifested itself differently, you know, maybe with my mom and my father, you know, or even my brother, but like, it was there. And I think that that is something that is unfortunately and really sadly very distinct to the Black experience, is not that other people don't experience depression, but it's so normalized. And, you know, a lot of people in my life, and, you know, this is somewhat similar to what David was talking about the things that he learned from women in his life that he was close to and their experiences. But there's even this whole idea of, like, you know, strong Black woman. And I've seen how that really can be harmful and destructive to a lot of Black women, because there's this idea that, like, you're supposed to be able to take anything that is put on your shoulders, that you're supposed to be able to carry any weight. You know what I mean? And that's not realistic. And so, yeah, when it comes to mental health, you know, and I have not been as brave or outspoken about my own experiences. I speak about it, but, like, you know, I know David and some other people are very upfront and out there about it. And I think it's important. I think it's important that other people can see it can be a lifelong thing, and it's real. And I think acknowledging that it's real is a very important first step that sadly too many people haven't taken.
Yeah, I remember hearing that line years ago in Chicago from a woman who was saying, we don't go to a psychiatrist, we go to church. Although, you know, hey, why not both?
Yeah. Well, but that's the thing, church has value. No, I can't tell you how many people, it's funny, because as I learned more, right, one of my best friends, he was talking about his stuff, and, you know, I'm just like, you're talking about depression, you know, and I specifically brought up, you know, treatment, speaking to somebody, seeking out these things. And he said, like, oh no, I have church, you know. And I definitely don't think that that's bad, but I think that it's a piece of the puzzle. You know what I mean? We're not any one thing. Human beings are complex. So yeah, like addressing some parts of it from a spiritual perspective, absolutely. But then, you know, the mind is a crazy and multifaceted thing, and you can't address it all by speaking to your pastor. You know.
Your pastor or pastors and Prozac will never be enough.
Yeah. That's another album title right there.
I was
going
to say.
You're giving away some gold.
Oh, what can I say? It's one of those days.
Yeah.
Well, what's next for you both?
Well, for me, there's, you know, I've always got a bunch of irons in the fire, and Marcus and I are working on trying to get a new book deal, something super top secret that will blow people's minds. And right now, I have another book that I'm writing that I can't talk about because it hasn't been announced yet. And then just about everything else is, you know, Bitter Root, which is a comic that I co-write with Chuck Brown, and that comes out through Image Comics. We're working on that. That's making its return in about a month. And really thinking about, I'd like to write some more prose, and I'm just not sure what that's going to be yet. Like, and by prose, I mean fiction. So, like, I have an idea for a murder mystery, and I think I might sit down and do that, but that's a whole other set of muscles. And it's a different type of discipline that right now I'm lacking. So, but we'll see. But this project that Marcus and I are talking about, man, and that's like a, if we make it happen, it's like about 2 years, 3 years away. So it's, oh man, comics can drive you crazy sometimes.
Yeah, that project that Dave's talking about, that's the big one. I'm also finishing book two of Snow Days, which is a long, 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 long time coming. And I'm excited about getting that into the world. I think I also want to spend a little bit of time this year just catching up on doing some paintings, like, you know, traditional paintings, because it's been a big part of, you know, what drives me artistically. And I love comics, but it's like, you know, comics are so intensive that as I've done a lot of comics work over the last couple of years, it just hasn't been as much time for the canvas. So, yeah.
Well, the book is The Black Panther Party, a graphic novel history. The writer is David F. Walker, and the artist is Marcus Kwame Anderson. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thanks for having us.
It's absolutely been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Now for our listeners who might be interested in your work, how can they find out more?
Me, just go to davidfwalker.com. It's all one word. I may not update the site that often, but it's got links to everything that you need to know about me, and you can find whatever you need to know.
Yeah, and similarly for me, Marcus Kwame, MacrusKwame.com. And yeah, it's got all of my socials, comic work, painting, everything. You can find it all there.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Kontzer. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. And a very special thanks to Ken Jones for his expert work engineering today's program. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7